Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight in this dreadful Sydney weather. It's good to have Helen Coonan back at the Sydney Institute. Of course, she's been here before, and most recently when she was communications minister in the Howard government. But I wouldn't say in front of Helen Coonan it's good to have her back in opposition, but it's good to have her back one way or the other. I'll introduce Senator Coonan very briefly. Her background, of course, was as a commercial barrister. She entered the Senate in 1996. As Senator for New South Wales in 2001, she was appointed to the ministry, becoming Assistant Treasurer and Minister for Revenue. And then later on, she was promoted to the Cabinet, became Minister for Communications and Deputy Leader in the Senate. And tonight, Senator Coonan's going to speak for us on the magic putting the economy under Labor. Senator Coonan, thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Jared, to Anne and the directors of the board and staff. As always, thank you for the opportunity to speak about matters of national and international importance. It's interesting that Jared mentioned the last time I was here, I was Minister for Communications. I somehow or other feel that nothing much has changed, and I could really just pick up and start talking about communications because nothing seems to have really moved on very much. But having recently been asked to become Shadow Minister for Finance, I've had to rethink what I would actually speak with you about tonight, because when I actually accepted the invitation, I was Shadow Foreign Affairs Minister. So juggling all these hats has its problems. But anyway, I thought I'd talk about the economy, and I propose to talk about it in a way that, because I know this is a mixed audience, in a way that I hope I will base it on facts, and we can have an interesting discussion later. And I apologise in advance if some of my comments sound a little bit pejorative. I don't mean it to be quite like that, but I just thought I would mention to start with that I do appreciate that there are always other views, and I'd be very interested to hear them. Whether Mr Rudd labels himself as an economic conservative, as he did, or a market socialist, I think matters really very little. I think it's becoming increasingly apparent that however he labels himself, he and his government are presiding over the economy as if it is a magic pudding. And they do seem to be struggling to come up with a coherent and sustainable plan to manage Australia's flagging economy, given, of course, that we have had unprecedented circumstances. But I think that all of the trumpeting about taking early and decisive action to deal with the economic crisis is only defensible to taxpayers and to the broader public if it is the right action and it actually gets results. The December national accounts, released on the 3rd of March 2009, shows that the Australian economy is going backwards on Mr Rudd's watch, and if we're not yet in a technical recession, it will surely feel like one to people who have lost their jobs and who are anxious about what the future may hold for them. This evening I'll examine four propositions that are germane to my central argument that the decisions made by the government on the economy in response to the global recession have failed to restore confidence in the economy and have only made Australia's economic situation worse. Before examining the four propositions, there are, however, I think a couple of points of general importance to be made about how the government is approaching its decision making. It's perfectly true, as the government emphasises ad nauseam, and we all hear many times a day, that there's a global financial crisis. It's how it is responded to that I think really matters. The government has embarked on an extreme spending spree, now totaling in the vicinity of $90 billion, in an attempt to spend its way out of the crisis, promising to create or protect 330,000 jobs. You might think that if that was the outcome, that might have been a price worth paying. But at the same time, the government acknowledges that it doesn't know whether its so-called decisive action is the correct response. No silver bullet, as Mr. Rudd has conceded. Now, that might be fair enough if the government can point to carefully calibrated policies that will, on the balance of probabilities, shield Australia from the worst of the economic slump. But the notion that just frenzied spending can be justified as a sure way, it acknowledges that it doesn't know whether its so-called decisive action is the correct response. No silver bullet, as Mr. Rudd has conceded. Now, that might be fair enough if the government can point to carefully calibrated policies that will, on the balance of probabilities, shield Australia from the worst of the economic slump. But the notion that just frenzied spending can be justified as a sure way of creating or maintaining real jobs rests, unfortunately, on no firmer footing than the application of a fiscal multiplier to estimate the bang you get for spending a buck. In short, all of the government's claims about taking quick and decisive action provides no guarantee of jobs in the real world. What is real, quantifiable and painful, unfortunately, is the numbers of jobs lost as unemployment heads inexorably towards 7% in the most recent official forecast, and that was before the economy went backwards in the December quarter. Moreover, in the government's anxiety to be ahead of the curve, which you will have heard, they've ended up, I think, out on a limb. Closer examination of the government's policy choices introduced in the last budget suggests that rather than acting on the best possible advice, they've embarked on actions that have resulted in insufficiently stress-tested and poorly targeted policy on the run, with resultant unintended consequences. An example: the government's unlimited deposit guarantee. We know that the Prime Minister did not seek the advice of the Governor of the Reserve Bank, who recommended that the guarantee should be capped as low as possible and left on for as short a time as possible. And as a consequence of the guarantee being unlimited, there was a run on non-guaranteed financial institutions and some 250,000 investors, many of them self-funded retirees, have had their investments frozen, and this has still not yet been resolved. Further unintended consequences soon became evident with the crowding out effect on private investment and on state and territory government borrowings. The Treasurer finally conceded the damage that lack of planning and poorly thought out policy design had caused by recently announcing that the Commonwealth would guarantee state government issued bonds to ensure the infrastructure investment didn't collapse. Now that cash-strapped state governments have been propped up, where does that now leave private investors? If public-private partnerships are to work, there needs to be private investment too. So will there be a queue of private investors seeking the guarantee? One commentator said the Treasurer is yet to meet a loan guarantee he can refuse. But the point about this is that the cascading unintended consequences of the original decision graphically illustrates that the benefits of taking quick action were subsumed by failure to think it through, to understand and think through the complexities before actually starting off on a course of action. Now, to return to my four propositions in support of the argument that the government's response to the global financial crisis is making Australia's economic position worse. First, I think it's reasonably clear that Australia, on winning government, Labor did inherit a sound economy. Australia's prospects of withstanding the severity of the global economic meltdown are better than comparable countries because of the sound fundamentals inherited from 11 years of conservative economic management under the Howard government. And that was in fact reinforced today by the Reserve Bank Deputy Governor Rick Battaglino in his report released today. Second, the Labor government did not, but should have, foreseen the rapidity and depth of the economic downturn in Australia and behaved more responsibly than they did when they got into government. And third, Australia's economic inheritance is now, in my submission and that of my party, being gambled away and squandered in casino-like giveaways and other poorly thought-out policy decisions that are not working the way they're claimed and that will leave future generations with a new legacy of deficit and debt. And fourthly, the government is unwilling to explain its policies or to accept responsibility for poor choices that they have failed to arrest Australia's deteriorating economic outlook. And I expect to deal with each of those and to prove my propositions, or at least arguably prove my propositions. And finally, I will suggest some approaches the coalition could develop to respond to the unfolding economic challenges faced by Australia. I'm not going to spend very much time on Australia's economic legacy because I'm sure you've heard ad nauseam probably that no incoming government in Australian history has inherited economic conditions as favourable to those inherited by Mr Rudd and the Labor government. Unemployment was at near historic lows. There were sustained high levels of economic growth, low inflation, real wages were rising across the economy, government debt had been eradicated, and people did have confidence in the strength of the economy. And it had been achieved because of fiscal discipline and a significant program of reform. And, of course, it was consistent budget surpluses that enabled the paying down of $96 billion of debt that was inherited from the former Labor government that has put Australia in a position where some of these cash flashes have been able to be paid for until, of course, we've now gone into deficit. Other critical economic achievements that are really standing us in very good stead that Mr Rudd has inherited includes a strong regulatory framework, a strong banking and prudential system, and of course an independent reserve bank. The four pillars banking policy that actually preceded the Howard government has acted as a restraint on risk-taking that caused foreign banks to get into trouble last year. So I think it can be fairly said, and in fact the Deputy Prime Minister was able to claim quite rightly that Australia's regulatory system was better than world class. And Mr Rudd and Labor did inherit a strong balance sheet that included a $21 billion fiscal surplus, a future fund, a communications fund, of which I was very proud, and an education fund. In March 2004, of course, we'd been described as the economy down under. And I contend that it was the heavy lifting done to achieve economic reform during the Howard years that enabled the current incumbents to claim repeatedly that Australia is better placed than most comparable countries in the OECD to weather the economic storm. Thank goodness we are. But the government did fail to see the global downturn coming. This is my second proposition. Australia wasn't immune. And while not significantly exposed to subprime lending because of strong prudential restraints, Australian businesses and the share market was affected by the downturn experienced internationally. Volatility in the Australian stock market foreshadowed the effects of the credit crunch hitting the real economy. Upon taking office, the government did ignore the warnings of the coming crisis and continued as if Australia was inoculated from the global downturn because of the commodities boom, that demand stemming from the growing economy of China would buoy Australian commodity exports and keep Australia out of recession. So as the rest of the world started to experience a sharp contraction, in February last year, Mr Rudd and Mr Swan started to talk down the economy with claims about the risks of inflation. Between 1996 and 2007, however, inflation had averaged 2.5%, right in the middle of the Reserve Bank target range. Yet the Treasurer claimed in February, in an interview on Sky Business Channel, that the former government let the inflation genie out of the bottle. Supposedly inflation had been on the march for 2 years, according to Mr Swan. Going one better than the Treasurer, the Prime Minister went over the top in Parliament on the 2nd of June last year and referred to an inflation monster. Let's look after families, not just for the short term, but for the long term, and deal effectively with the inflation monster, he proclaimed. the rhetoric of the inflation genie was, I think, a clear ploy designed to do two things. It did, of course, discredit the coalition's economic record. I assume that's what was intended. And it did justify, if you believed it, increased taxes in the May budget that funded Labor's increases in spending. The government was very keen for us to believe that the Howard government had presided over runaway inflation, and they seized upon inflationary pressures because of the very low unemployment rate, and talked up inflation and egged on the Reserve Bank to lift interest rates. In September 2008, the national accounts showed the interest rate rises in early 2008 had caused damage to the economy. Before the collapse of Lehman Brothers in mid-September last year, economic growth had come to a standstill. Talking the economy down was not a successful way to manage pressures in the economy, although it may have had short-term political benefits, I concede that. Before the financial crisis hit Australia, some of the effects of it were becoming evident, but the government's overblown political rhetoric had already served to undermine consumer confidence precisely at the wrong time. Even in June last year, well before the crisis hit, consumer confidence, as measured by the Westpac Melbourne Institute Index of Consumer Sentiments, had collapsed to a then 16-year low. At that time, the economy was forecast to grow by a sound 2.75%, 2.75%. There was a large budget surplus and unemployment was at a very low 4.2%. Why then were consumers so gloomy? By early November, Mr Rudd had changed his tune. The rhetoric was dark. He said, tough, it will be difficult, it will be hard, it will be ugly, particularly when you look at the unfolding economic data from around the world and the beginning of a global recession. Prior to the federal election, Peter Costello, of course, had warned of a coming economic tsunami. He was pilloried at the time for doing that. But by last month, Mr Rudd was echoing Mr Costello's economic tsunami warning. He said, "The global economic recession is the equivalent of an economic cyclone, spreading from continent to continent, leaving wreckage in its wake, devastating jobs and crushing the dreams and livelihoods of families across the world." And so in the course of just 12 months, the government had veered from threatening the consequences of an inflation genie monstering the Australian economy to dire warnings of an economic cyclone sweeping all in its wake. The government surprisingly failed to see the signs of the coming crisis, and they failed to adequately plan for it and must accept responsibility for their failure to do so. And now here is the critical point, and this is my third proposition. While overblown rhetoric may damage confidence in the short term, what is of, and what unfortunately I think will be, of lasting and profound significance is the way in which Australia's economic inheritance is being gambled away by Labor's magic pudding approach to the budget. Nothing could have prepared Australians for the mind-blowing cash splash, spend and guarantee bonanza that was about to unfold after September 2008, plunging the country once again into deficit and debt and contingent liabilities now that could reach $1 trillion. Included in this unrestrained pledge of the nation's credit are a guarantee of retail bank deposits and wholesale borrowings from other banks, $8 billion to prop up small banks and credit unions, $10.4 billion pre-Christmas cash splash giveaway, $6.2 billion bailout for the car industry, $2 billion for car dealerships, $15.1 billion boost in new money to the states, $300 million for local government, $4.7 billion for transport infrastructure and universities, $2 billion for the infamous Rudd Bank, which will be matched by a further $500 million each from the big four commercial banks underpinning commercial property companies, a government guarantee for Rudd Bank of $26 billion to add to the $2 billion, $42 billion for the government's second stimulus package, another government guarantee, this time for debt issued by the states and territories, $700 million for tax relief on POYG instalments for small business cash flow that was announced a few days ago, which all totals a whopping $91.4 billion. If all this causes you taxpayers to catch your breath, the Treasurer has also hinted at yet another stimulus package in the budget. In this giddy spendathon, the government has now committed Australians to $200 billion of debt, an unprecedented amount for Australia. Remember that it took almost the entire term of the Howard government to repay the former Labor government's $96 billion debt. The government and Treasury have also been vague about how many billions in interest costs will be necessary to finance the debt, but have not refuted the fact that every Australian man, woman and child will be saddled with 9,500 additional debt. The government also has no credible strategy to return the budget to surplus. If anyone can find one, let me know, nor any commitment as to when that might be. The updated economic and fiscal outlook, released on the 3rd of February, revealed a deficit of $118 billion over the forward estimates, with a forecast deficit of $22.5 billion in 08-09 and $35.5 billion in 09-10. However, there are now concerns that the deficit could blow out significantly from these numbers, with some estimates as high as $30 billion this year and $60 billion next year. To that end, it's worth stating that based on the updated economic and fiscal outlook, the one I just mentioned, the budget would be in surplus in 08-09 had it not been for decisions since the May budget that account for $67 billion over the forward estimates, including $29 billion in 08-09. But leaving to one side for a moment the risks, distortions and moral hazard caused by massive government interventions in the market, taxpayers would be entitled to assume, I think, with that sort of spend, that these interventions will work. They would be sadly mistaken. The December accounts clearly show that the majority of the pre-Christmas cash giveaway was saved by most householders and not spent as intended. Now, saving is not a bad thing, don't get me wrong about that, but the purpose of the package was to spend, spend, spend. Increases in household consumption of just 0.1% failed to boost business, with the recent Access Economics retail forecast concluding that Australian retailers will only tread water in the first half of 2009. And where, I ask, are the 75,000 jobs the Prime Minister promised would be created if the taxpayer spent $10.4 billion in the pre-Christmas cash flash? Sadly, the stimulus seems to have failed all of the objectives as the country shot into negative territory in the December quarter. The same can be predicted, I think, of the $42 billion stimulus, which was introduced into Parliament at a time when there was no evidence to conclude whether or not the December cash splash was successful. Treasury Secretary Dr. Ken Henry told the Senate Finance and Public Administration Committee, that I dutifully sat on because I was interested in this question, that the success of the $42 billion package may never be known. He said, and I quote, "It's going to be difficult for us to provide the Parliament with the precise estimates of the actual fiscal impact of the package." The prospects for the $29 billion infrastructure component of the $42 billion stimulus package are no more promising than the $13 billion cash splash component. Quite apart from whether billions earmarked variously for pink bats and boom gates and painting primary school halls are an effective investment in nation building and jobs, how quickly this happens is of course dependent on the state's capacity to respond. I'll say no more about that. Now, it is fair to say that opinions of economists differ as to the effectiveness and composition of fiscal stimulus. The recently published open letter to the American president, signed by 200 economists, including three Nobel laureates, caused a stir when they wrote, in part, to improve the... It's a triumph of hope over experience to believe that more government spending will help the US today. To improve the economy, policymakers should focus on reforms that remove impediments to work, saving, investment and production. Lower tax rates and a reduction in the burden of government are the best ways of using fiscal policy to boost growth. Similarly, the Coalition advocated a more modest stimulus, which includes proposals that better target business, such as temporarily reducing superannuation guarantee payments and assist in meeting the burden of employment to help keep people in jobs, as well as bringing forward tax cuts. The Coalition warned at the time that the stimulus was too big, too early and poorly targeted. As economics professor Tony Macon has commented, the government sought to boost consumption in the short term with a go early, go hard, go household response, whereas a sounder approach would have been the exact opposite, go later, go easy, go firms. Now, this might be a matter of opinion, but although the massive cash splash has failed to halt what the Prime Minister now admits is an inevitable recession, he appears undaunted in his enthusiasm for stimulus packages, added on the world stage in the lead-up to the G20 summit, spruiking for the US and the UK, calling for yet more fiscal stimulus and massive spending. Whether the world, of course, can continue to spend its way out of recession seems to have some powerful dissenters, with Europe now questioning the value of this approach. The upshot of all this is that taxpayers have once again been saddled with a massive debt, and the budget must sustain massive borrowings to pay for it. We can only hope that Australia will remain competitive in the crowded sovereign bond market, and that global investors won't be deterred by the rapid escalation of debt and the extent of the budget deficit. We contend that Labor has spent the nation's economic inheritance for little immediate gain, with much more long-term damage to come from increased tax and inflation. I will talk a little bit about some of the problems about getting an explanation of what this all means. We're not doing too well in Parliament when we ask for an explanation. There's a bit of a dismissive air and refusal to explain decisions, provide information that we've seen time and again in Parliament and in the media. Here are some examples of what passes for explanation by political leaders in Australia. Westpac's chief economist Bill Evans spoke out recently regarding the December stimulus package. Among other things, Mr. Evans stated that the consumer spending increased by just 0.1%, well below trend. There was no boost to household incomes. And Shadow Treasurer Joe Hockey put Mr. Evans' view, his opinion, to Treasurer Swan as he questioned the impact of the stimulus package. Mr. Swan replied, "Those opposite are continuing to play this silly political game. The first part of it is that we should not engage in any economic stimulus to support jobs. They have this proposition that Australia should simply sit and wait and see as a global recession rolls over the country. That is the proposition that those opposite are putting." Well, of course, we hadn't. So we did ask about the effect of the stimulus on job creation, specifically how many jobs had indeed been created thanks to the cumulative spend thus far. Mr. Rudd said, "The Honourable Member's question goes to the impact of the stimulus measures on jobs. The alternative and the dividing line between us and this Parliament is as clear as day. The Liberal Party stands for sitting, waiting and doing nothing. This government has a clear plan of action." So, as you will see, we haven't been very successful in getting anything like a clear explanation as to what is really intended to be achieved by the stimulus package and, indeed, how it's going. Mr. Rudd and his ministers do, of course, have very neat 5-second grabs for the news, but it does little to enlighten the rest of us as to whether the Prime Minister can properly explain his government's policies and whether, in fact, there's any evidence for what he actually asserts. It's fair enough to ask, then, what the Coalition would be doing differently to respond to the global financial crisis. As I've demonstrated, we certainly wouldn't be starting from here. If that doesn't sound too Irish, apologies to the Irish in our midst. We do recognise that there are a number of emerging national and international pressures that will require careful handling and great care to get right for Australia. The size and complexity of the matters being grappled with by the Group of 20 at the London meeting on the 2nd of April are eye-popping. Thorny issues include an extended role for the International Monetary Fund, strengthening the Financial Stability Forum, and pitching for new global financial architecture, all taking place against a bold US plan to remove toxic debt from the balance sheets of stricken banks. Now, added to the mix is the controversial call by China's central bank governor to replace the greenback with a new global currency reserve, and the ever-present threat of protectionism, evident in subsidies and targeted industry assistance in many stimulus packages throughout the world. Although Australia has not experienced the severe stresses on the financial system that contributed to the failure of the banking system in the US and UK, Australia does have a vital interest in seeing the removal of toxic assets as a fundamental step to restoring confidence in the global financial system and in restoring credit flows. We think it's appropriate that Mr. Rudd is at the G20 and that he's properly addressing these matters. But we need to be careful to ensure that calls to broaden and strengthen global financial regulation do not detract from effective financial regulation Australia already has in place. Following the fallout from the collapse of HIH, Australia's biggest general insurer, as the Assistant Treasurer, I worked with the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority, APRA, to overhaul supervision, including strengthening capital adequacy, stress testing and other prudential requirements. These reforms have largely shielded Australia from systemic failure of our financial institutions and from some of the worst effects of the global recession. In the biannual Financial Stability Review, released on the 25th of March 2009, the Reserve Bank Governor has again confirmed the sound position of our banks. We should be resisting the notion when it comes to proposals for global financial regulation that one size fits all, whilst at the same time being open to the possibilities for enhancement that alignment with an improved international system could bring. As ASIC's Chairman Tony D'Aloisio pointed out in an address on the 26th of March, a few days ago, Australia will need to respond to recommendations for more effective global regulatory oversight. Inevitably, this is going to mean some additional regulation, but this should not relieve us, particularly parliamentarians, of the important objective of reducing the regulatory burden on the financial services industry where possible. Regulation for regulation's sake can never be justified. The government had made a big song and dance about deregulation, even putting it in the title and responsibility of the Minister for Finance. Promising a one-in, one-out approach, pinched from the UK, the government pledged not to introduce new regulation without tossing one out, which I support. So far, we've seen little evidence of this being taken seriously, as more and more regulation gets heaped on industry without obvious benefit for consumers. Regulation should be introduced where it's necessary. It must be effective. If it's not, it should be removed. Now, apart from reducing the compliance burden on business, more needs to be done to put Australia in pole position to take advantage of the opportunities that will flow from economic recovery. While features of this economic downturn may well be different from anything previously seen, confidence in the market needs to be restored. Looking out for small business is a case in point. Inexplicably, while the government has been prepared to give out cash to prop up ailing and inefficient industries, to invest in pink bats and risk the taxpayers all in guarantees for large institutions and property companies, they've remained curiously disengaged with the plight of small business. Apart from the 30% tax break on new equipment in the earlier stimulus package and the PAYG tax break, small business has not directly benefited from the government's spending. The Labor government's if you like, neglect of small business, I think, is puzzling, especially given estimates that Australian small businesses employ 3.6 million people, providing a huge percent, in fact 47% of private sector non-agricultural employment. The Coalition has been a consistent advocate for small business. We've argued that a more effective fiscal stimulus would have assisted cash flow in a meaningful way, and that any stimulus would focus on productivity rather than consumption. Leaving out assistance for business, I think, was a serious miscalculation in the approach to the stimulus. For many small businesses, it will be too little too late to restore their shattered confidence. But for many struggling firms, the most crippling obstacle they face is the credit drought, as funds become unavailable or prohibitively expensive as lenders re-rate risk. While some reductions in official cash rates have been passed on by banks, many viable small firms remain stymied by lack of available credit. The government is in a strong position to urge the banks that, as they are, after all, the beneficiaries of taxpayer-backed guarantees, they can do better. The government must insist that banks do more to assist creditworthy businesses. How to do this was explored at the recent Small Business Roundtable, but so far this initiative does not seem to have been a wild success in assisting small businesses to access available credit. I think it should be revisited. We take the view that freeing up credit for business that will let the market operate will be of more lasting benefit to the economy than a grab bag of handouts and treats that significantly rewards inefficient players at the expense of others. To finish, the Coalition remains optimistic that out of the global upheaval will come renewal and opportunity. There are lessons to be learnt, of course, but it will be important that the rebuilt system doesn't stifle innovation and initiative, the lifeblood of the economy, that we don't go under the doona and not come out when it comes to actually rebuilding the business climate. As the chairman of the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China said recently, we shouldn't reject the need for innovation in financial services merely because it carries some element of risk with it. In China, we say you can't stop eating just because you're afraid of choking on your food. Now, therein lies a lesson for a true fiscal conservative. Thank you very much.
Many thanks, Senator Kernan, and thanks to CAUSE for the use of this facility this evening, this wet Sydney evening. So we come to questions and discussion. In 1996, John Howard was accused of not having many policies, but in fact he had a couple that distinguished him quite substantially from Labor, and a similar accusation was made against Kevin Rudd at the last election, but he had a couple of policies that distinguished himself from the Coalition. If there was an election on, say, in the next 3 or 4 months, what would you pinpoint to say as the 1, 2, or 3 big issues where you would say you were dramatically different from Labor?
Right. I think that's a very difficult thing to do, as we're currently going through a very extensive policy review process. And for my sins, I get the fun side of it because I have to make all the numbers add up and with the equivalent of an expenditure review. So I don't want to hazard my arm and the goodwill of my colleagues by picking things out. But quite clearly, I think we have to move on. We can't be looking backwards. And I think that part of going out of government, particularly when you've been in government for a long time, Jared, is recognising that voters have made a decision, and so you don't need to cling to policies that didn't find favour. So the real question then is to look forward, to look to the future, and part of looking to the future is to look at what the government is doing wrong, and or what we think is doing wrong. And, of course, the critical thing is going to be how to really rebuild the Australian economy. I mean, this is going to be quite significant with the debt and deficit that, once again, we're going to inherit. So I would think that going into the next election, all of our election promises would need to be cost neutral, and that would be our most significant commitment, that we will get the country back on its feet from an economic perspective. Obviously, if you look at bigger structural changes in the economy, that really never goes away. You can never assume that everything's done, and we know that despite all the Labor government's talk about infrastructure, in fact, I really can't think of anything they've done. They talked a great deal about infrastructure, and they still talk a great deal about infrastructure, but nothing, in fact, has happened, but it is critical. And then I think the third thing that is going to be very important is to make sure that we rebuild ourselves so that we've got an attractive team, and that's a combination of people with experience and new people. So while that's not exactly a policy, it's certainly something that I think will underpin a very careful description of how we will be different from Labor.
So there's a question here and here.
Did I correctly understand you that some colleagues of yours were predicting the global financial downturn? As I understand it, no politician anywhere in the world did predict this. Even Alan Greenspan, as an economist, said no economist predicted. Now, to contradict Alan Greenspan, I know at least of 5 to 10 books written by economists who have predicted a trouble within the economic system, even up to 10 years ago. So did I understand you correctly that you predicted?
What I said was that Mr. Costello that Mr. Costello in October of 2007 had looked at some of the indicators and had said that he thought that the country and the world would be facing an economic tsunami. That was the colleague that I referred to. But the point in my proposition that I was referring to was that Mr. Rudd and Mr. Swan, not only didn't they see it coming, I mean, they may well have been forgiven for that, but they actually were talking about inflation and pushing Australia in entirely the wrong direction when the movement worldwide, globally, was that there was a sharp downturn coming and a sharp contraction. And as I understand it, they were looking at, and a lot of people were looking at the decoupling theory, you know, of China from, you know, the US economy. There were a lot of signs there that might have suggested that Australia could weather it. We're in a better position to weather it, that we wouldn't be as severely impacted. And in fact, we haven't been. But it was, in my view, and those of a lot of my colleagues, that destroying confidence in the broader business community and talking about inflation and then suddenly doing a 90-degree turn and talking about an economic cyclone really didn't help. And consumer confidence had collapsed well before that happened.
One of the things that the Rudd government announced very recently that they'd be doing to bring budget back into a neutral position eventually is actually cutting coalition policies like the baby bonus, the family tax benefit, and other policies that were considered tax trap by economists and were criticised at the time of the coalition government. I wonder if you could comment on the criticism that those policies that were middle-class welfare but was quite wasteful, and whether you think that the coalition now, if it were in power, would cut those policies too in order to save money?
Well, I really can't preempt how we'd react if we were there, other than to say that you obviously look very critically when you're preparing a budget. You look very critically at what you need to do and what your overall objective is. And Labor has talked a bit about wanting to get the budget back into surplus when trend growth is resumed, but they haven't said when that'll be, and it is very vague, which is why I've said I don't think they have a credible alternative. But talking about so-called middle-class welfare, I cannot believe the waste that went on in the stimulus package, for instance, that wasn't means-tested at all. When you find people getting it who are living overseas, you know, $76 million going to people who don't live in Australia that are certainly not going to stimulate the Australian economy, to people who are unfortunately deceased. And if you look at waste, you've got to look right across the board at waste. And I think it's terribly important when you're formulating a policy that you look at the policy purpose, what you're trying to achieve, and whatever the criticisms are of baby bonuses and so-called middle-class welfare, they achieve their objective at the time that they are introduced. I don't think that the stimulus will be able to claim the same thing.
Yes, I'm very concerned that as China has been buying up access to mineral resources in Africa and in Brazil, if we sell them our access to our mines and so on, we're going to find ourselves in a very bad position in the future.
Yes, well, look, I think that's a perfectly legitimate view, and I think everyone in the room is not only concerned about but aware of the very special significance of losing control over your resources. And getting into a situation where, you know, China's a, you know, a price maker, not only a price taker. So this is going to be a very difficult decision for the Treasurer, and we struggled with many of these decisions. I've approved a lot of FIRB decisions, smaller ones, in my capacity as Assistant Treasurer, and it's a very difficult process. Usually you accept the recommendation that's made to you by the Board, but this is one that, of course, is going to cause a lot of heartburn, and I don't know whether or not there's any additional safeguards that you can look to. I think enforcing, making enforceable undertakings against a company like Chinalco could be very difficult. And, of course, we're dealing with a non-renewable resource. Now, all of these things have to be taken into account. And the broad objective is the national interest. That's not really defined anywhere. And it's the Treasurer's discretion. So let's hope he's staying awake tonight worrying about it. Well, I think it really depends on what kind of priorities they're going to Labor have for their budget, apart from not going too deeply into deficit. I mean, we already know they're in deep deficit. So that will mean some very difficult decisions. Now, we know that they're going to, as we support this, they really do need to do something about the tax and transfer system, about retirement incomes and about pensions. We had called for pensions to be supplemented, and we absolutely support the fact that this should be something that receives attention, and they've said that that will happen in this budget. Now, what else comes, goodness knows. I must say this is my personal view. It's not necessarily the Coalition's view, although it may become the Coalition's view as we start to do our policy review. I can't believe that we haven't got a good maternity leave policy. I think it's very important, and if you're serious about women in the workforce and allowing, you know, all of the productivity gains of skilling a workforce and allowing people to have families as well, we have to get our head as a nation around this idea of maternity leave. What form it takes and how it works may be open to argument, but I do think we need a policy.
Yes. What is your view on measures taken by the government to restrict termination pay to business executives? And do you think there is ever a role for government to play in this regard?
Look, I think that some of the most egregious examples of executive remuneration and executive pay have meant that, from a political perspective, it would be almost impossible for the government not to have acted. It may not be perhaps the best economic policy to intervene like that, but my view is this. I do think there needs to be something done about it, and our view has been that it really should be a matter that's up to shareholders, and there should be a binding vote. In other words, instead of just some sort of indicative objection, they need to actually be able to make their vote count, because they're in a position to assume the risk, to understand what objectives they've got for a particular company. What concerns me is that if governments intervene too much, you get distortions and you find things like that a company is disadvantaged because it can't attract a particular CEO they wanted. Now, all that assumes that there's not the wit to get around it. There's a lot of very thorny issues, but I think in principle, yes, there needs to be something done, but you've got to be very careful about it being, you know, putting specific limits on it. We did think that shareholders should be able to have a binding vote, because they're the ones that assume the risk and get the benefit if they get it right, and pay for it if they get it wrong, and that's the way it should be with the company. But I think that the broader community has been so offended by some of the large excess that politically I do understand why the government has acted.
Senator Coonan, I was wondering whether there was any hope for senior executives. We've got two sons, one late 40s, one 50, both out of work, both the families. They will not go on welfare because we don't do that. And it's a desperate situation. Right. What about the outsourcing of so many jobs? Today I spoke to a girl in the Philippines. Yesterday I spoke to somebody in Wuppo. Just I was cancelling subscriptions and things. What can we do about this?
Well, look, I used to have this discussion with people when I looked after information technology, because obviously a lot of IT jobs get outsourced, and at that stage, I don't know whether it would still apply, but at that stage, it seemed to be that the best answer to outsourcing was to grow jobs onshore and to have policies that would actually mean that, you know, high-end, high-value jobs were being created in Australia. And that was the approach that we took, particularly with IT contracts. I don't think there's a better answer to that, because you do find that you've got instances like Pacific Brands and, you know, all of these companies, particularly manufacturing companies, who simply can't compete if the low-skilled jobs remain onshore. But I think that really we've got to be cleverer and smarter about creating, you know, jobs as the economy picks up. There'll always be opportunities, and that's the kind of economy we want, a smart workforce, a smart economy that can take advantage of new jobs in new industries.
Small businesses close down, though.
Yes.
And the jobs aren't there.
Yeah. Well, that was my point, that I think small business has been appallingly neglected.
In Moscow, where we are most of the time, down there, which I frequent to buy almonds in China, and that said that most of that stimulus package went on the pokies in our area.
Yes.
I mean, that's not very good, is it?
No, look, it's not good. I mean, I assume that there would be a lot of people who would have been very grateful to get it too, and it would have been much needed. I don't cavil with the fact that people genuinely needed it and whatever. No, I think we have to realise that it's not everybody who goes and spends it on the pokies. But my point was that it wasn't very well targeted. If it all went on a splash on consumers spending or consumer saving, rather than trying to do more for jobs and to keep people in work.
Not Cobden. Senator, I think the opposition is quite properly gone further than that. And it seems to me that you've also opposed where that has taken place. I'm thinking, for example, of the guarantee, which, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the place involved in there seems to be now working quite well. And without that, we would have seen, you know, massive problems in the motor industry. It's also opposed, immediately opposed, the so-called, despite the fact that realistically the worst that could happen. So you, as I said, you say that the assistance should be targeted, but where there is time.
Well, I think what we're really saying is that if you're going to have a general stimulus, what you obviously need to do is to put it more on the productive, on the production side rather than the consumer side. That's the first point. But coming to your point, Milton, about some of the industry subsidies. If you look at Rudbank, I respectfully disagree, because what is at risk, quite frankly, is not only the initial $2 billion to be added to the $500 million of each of the four banks, but the Commonwealth alone is guaranteeing a further $26 billion of the borrowings of Rudbank, without really a governance structure around it where anything to do with the taxpayer is actually being either protected, nor is it transparent. We don't even yet know what a viable asset is. We don't know what this is actually designed to do, apart from obviously take out that part of a syndicated loan of a foreign bank if they leave. Now, the other critical issue with Rudbank is there is not a skerrick of evidence that has been brought to us before the policy was put in place that any actually plan to leave, apart from, I had a briefing with Treasury on this, and I said to them, what is the evidence that that banks are going to leave? And they said, we haven't got any, apart from the Royal Bank of Scotland, and of course that was subject to a takeover. So far, it's entirely a speculative policy, with some really bad things attached to it when you actually look at the legislation. Now, it's gone to a Senate inquiry. It will obviously give those participating an opportunity to tease out some of this. But if it's really going to be rescuing a viable asset, what's wrong with any of our current banks taking it up. I mean, it's a bit of a non sequitur. And this argument that I find very difficult to deal with, that it would be worse unless we did it, but no one can ever really prove how much worse it would be or how much better it's been, is really a bit of a non sequitur. Like this idea, well, it'd be so much worse, we'd lose more jobs unless we did it, but in fact people are losing jobs anyway, so how many are being saved? So it's a bit of the same argument. And I just think that it's gone, there's just too much spending, too much debt, without enough evidence that it's actually going to have the claimed benefits.
We don't have time for two quick questions. Stuart and Julian, but we've got to finish within about 5 minutes. So
Stuart?
Taking your criticism tonight about government, what do you think is the reason or your explanation for approval rate?
Good question. It's a very good question, and well, I think it's two things. The government is 15 months old. I think we Australians, when we make a decision about electing a government, we give them a go. You're not going to be throwing people out without making sure that, you know, they've done what they can do and they've had an opportunity to do what they have said they will do. So I think that that's a very important part. Historically, we know that newly elected governments do pretty well with the public. The second thing is I think it takes a while for disillusionment to set in, and to a certain extent it's not what oppositions do. I mean, sometimes I think we could run naked down George Street and nobody would notice. But it's what the government does that eventually loses them government. And I think that there's the kernel here of some decisions that will come back to bite the Rudd government. I don't know when it will be. And it's only really when disillusionment sets in that the electorate starts to think about an alternate. They mightn't like the alternate and they might re-elect the other government, but they might start looking at the other crowd and start to wonder what would be like. And there's a certain point in the psyche of the nation where they make a commitment to the alternate. But it is a process, and I think a lot of it has got to do with the historical way in which the electorate behaves in Australia. And the second point is that it's a very new government, and it will take a while before people start to say, hang on a minute, we don't like that. Let's see if the others can offer anything better.
I wonder if anything you've heard recently has made you more convinced, from Stephen Connery, that is, more convinced about ISP level.
No, since I know you'd like to spend a long time with it. Have to have a brief answer. Back to the old communications
stage. Very brief. Poor old Steve, put it that way. Look, I think it's such a dumb idea, and it really the
no,
short...
We're talking here about the filtering system.
ISP level.
Look, the answer to this, I think, is choice. I was always very satisfied that offering people choice to put their own filter on if they wished and to exercise a degree of parental care over their children that they wish and that they should was really an empowering kind of policy rather than some blanket requirement on ISPs. Now, that's still my position.
Many thanks. That was very quick.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Well, at the Sydney Institute here, we've always been interested to hear the word of the opposition, and that was so in the days of the Hawke and Keating government when we had many Liberals along, and was true in the time of the Howard government when he had many Labor people along. And we're now back with a Labor government, and we've had Julie Bishop and now Helen Coonan this year. And as we all know, Helen Coonan and her colleagues have a very important role in the general government process, because if they support the Rudd government's legislation, it gets through the Senate. And if they don't, then it goes into negotiations with the Greens and the Independents. So thanks for coming along tonight, Senator, and talking about the Coalition's economic policies with a particular focus on your responsibilities as Shadow Finance Minister. It's still halfway to the next election, and it's an important time for all of us. So we're grateful you came tonight. Your talk will be up on our podcast tomorrow or the next day, and your paper will be published in due course in the Sydney papers. But until next time, thanks. Well
done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.